This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. First up this week, our news roundup, including the Stego Smackdown. Oh, yeah. There's news this week about everyone's favorite dinosaur, the Stegosaurus, and how we might be able to tell males and females apart based on those spikes on their backs. And that news has caused quite a ruckus in the science community. Ariel Duham Ross, she's here. She's a science reporter at The Verge. She joins us back in our New York studios.
Hi, Ara.
Good to see you again, Ariel.
Hi.
A Stego Smackdown.
Right. Well, there was a study in Plus One this week, and it basically, like you said, it looked at the sex differences. So a lot of animals, you can tell whether it's a male or a female based, you know, visually from afar. For instance, moose have, you know, very large antlers and the females don't, or the male has like a very bright plumage for peacocks. But in this situation, the scientists thought that, like, one researcher thinks that you can tell Stegosaurus apart, male and female, by these spines that they have on their backs. And the idea is that the males maybe have wider plates than the females. Unfortunately, while we were doing our reporting, we found out that a lot of researchers kind of objected to the researchers' findings. It's possible that they do have sex differences like that, mm-hmm. but some researchers say that, you know, it's unclear whether these animals were actually fully grown. It's unclear whether it was even, you know, animals of the same species. But the main researcher said, you know, I did all of these tests. I was aging the right. plates. He aged the plates using kind of something similar to what you would do to age a tree with tree rings. You know, the idea is that it's just, in essence, what we can take away from this study and the controversy over this is that it's really, really hard to find out if dinosaurs have sex differences based on, you know, bones and fossils from 150 million years ago. Right. That's a really difficult thing. And to date, we don't have any solid evidence that dinosaurs did display these types of, you know, sex differences.
There's nothing like a good dinosaur controversy on the internet to spark. Because people love dinosaurs. They'll jump
on anything
they can to talk about it.
Yeah.
All right, move on to what else do you have for us this week?
Two bee studies. So as some of your listeners might have heard, there is a fairly big problem right now with bees. It's called colony collapse disorder. Honeybees, bumblebees, wild bees in the U.S. have been in decline since the mid-2000s. And, you know, it's something that's really worrisome because bees are used to pollinate crops. They're actually really important for agriculture. So when this was first discovered, for, you know, people first started realizing that the bees were in decline, one of the main hypotheses that came out of that was that an insecticide called a neonicotinoid was responsible for the decline. Mm-hmm. The problem is that studies that have come out of looking how, you know, bees react to them, honeybees namely, is that honeybees just seem to be disoriented by it, and maybe their immune system is lowered somewhat and then weakened. But it's unclear. It doesn't seem to really kill them. The way this insecticide is used, by the way, is that seeds are coated in it. And then as plants grow, it permeates throughout the entire plant, including the nectar and the pollen. And so in the first study, what they did is that they soaked seeds and then planted them. In eight fields, and in another set of eight fields, they only used a fungicide. And what they found is that bumblebees and wild bees, their population density declined significantly, you know, to half where they would have been otherwise. The honeybees, however, didn't really have any difference. This is kind of troublesome because we tend to use honeybees a lot in the research on bees in general. Bumblebees and wild bees are harder to work with. So it shows that, you know, our studies of this insecticide may not have been, you know, fully representative because it appears that the decline in honeybees is not neonicotinoids probably aren't the main factor. They may still have an effect on these colonies, but they're probably not the main reason that we're having these issues.
Well, they've always talked about multiple factors being involved. That might weaken the bees, and then lead to that colony collapse.
Exactly.
Let's talk about a story also that's been in the news, this gene editing. This has been very interesting.
Right. So this is a very controversial study. It was published this week in Protein and Cell. It was actually rejected from Nature and Science for ethical reasons. Yeah, the journal cited ethical reasons. And essentially, for the first time, researchers have successfully edited the genome of human embryos. Before anybody, you know, becomes very worried, they did not establish a pregnancy with these embryos. They also used embryos that would not have been viable.
This uses a new technique, right? New technique.
Right. They used a cutting-edge gene editing technique. And essentially what they did is that they tried to modify the gene responsible for a lethal blood disorder. So in 86 non-viable embryos, they inserted a genetic material that's intended to replace the genetic material that causes the disorder. Mm-hmm. Only 71 embryos survived, and really only a fraction of the embryos showed the genetic material. So even despite using this like really cutting edge gene editing technique, it only worked in some embryos. And what's worse is that a lot of them, the editing did not work on all the cells, which means that some of the embryos had some good copies of the gene and also some bad copies. That's really worrisome because it means that if we were to use this for a pregnancy, it's possible that while testing the embryos to find out if the technique worked, a doctor could sample cells that showed that it had indeed worked, but it would be the case that the child that would be born would actually still have the disorder. So really it just shows that we aren't there yet.
Where was this study done?
In China.
And this is the kind of thing that scientists a few months ago said they wanted to stop research,
right,
and talk about it because it could potentially so harmful.
Right. Well, I think that editorial that was published actually was there had been rumors that this had been performed, and they wrote that editorial in response to the rumors. Mm-hmm. And now it's official. It has happened. And really, the science is just we really aren't there yet.
So that's why it was rejected. Let's talk about, I always ask you to bring in something a little quirky.
Right.
You got something for us this week?
Yeah, we have a mosquito study. We have a lot of information about maybe why some mosquitoes tend to bite some people rather than others. People who are infected with malaria tend to attract mosquitoes, certain types of skin bacteria. But now we have evidence that genes also play a role. So some researchers compared how attractive sets of twins were to mosquitoes using groups of identical twins and groups of fraternal twins. And what they found is that the identical twins seemed to be as attractive, both sets of twins. They were similarly attractive to the mosquitoes, whereas the fraternal twins, which don't share as much genetic material, weren't.
So that showed there was something genetic.
Yeah, there seems to be a genetic component to whether or not you end up riddled with mosquito bites after going out into the forest.
Yeah. But we don't know what that is yet. We just know that...
No, and it's a small study. It was a really small study, so that might actually be a problem. We need to do more research. And it's also not clear if whatever is attracting, whatever your genes are producing, the chemicals that your genes are producing, are attractive or repellent. That we don't know yet. There's a lot of research to come on that.
Yeah, because, we always think that we've been hearing for years that it's the mosquitoes are attracted to your CO2.
Right.
To breathe out.
Right. There is that too, and there is evidence for that. When people do a lot of exercise or, when they tend to expel a lot of carbon dioxide, mosquitoes are attracted to that. But at some point, within a certain range, skin odor takes over, and that's actually what attracts mosquitoes.
Let's talk about one last one that you have here.
Sure. So the FBI released a preliminary report where they were... They admitted that 26 out of 28 of their examiners in a specific unit, microscopic hair comparison unit, probably overstated the importance of some forensic matches in some cases that happened before 2000. And this is a big problem because a lot of the people, they did this in 95% out of 268 trials, and a lot of these people were actually sentenced to death. Not all of these sentences have been carried out, but this may actually be a huge problem. And it shows that forensic science is a very advanced science, but that there's a lot that we still don't understand, and we still don't know how well and how good the science actually is.
What was the where was the mistake made in doing what?
It was during the trials when these examiners would testify. They often were more likely to say that the matches were closer to, for instance, if they had somebody who was accused of a crime other, you know, that they had selected, found some evidence on the crime scene, some hairs on the crime scene, they were more likely to say that the match was very close. The problem with that is that we don't actually know how many, we don't have any research that shows that hairs are very similar. You know, we don't know if some people might actually have hairs that are very, very similar. And it's all microscopic. It's all visual. So that's actually kind of a problem.
Yeah, so it was a little too broad then.
Right.
Research tried to cover too much.
Right.
And that was in hundreds of cases?
It's a preliminary report. They're actually reviewing thousands of cases.
Thousands of cases.
But right now we only have the results for 268 trials. We also are waiting to find out what exactly was the cause of these testimonies, why they were carried out that way. We don't know whether the researchers did this knowingly or not. So really, there's a lot of information that we don't have
and
yet.
And that's caused a lot of controversy.
Well, it's possible. There's other evidence in trials, not just this kind of evidence. But it's possible that some people may have been wrongfully incarcerated, and they would have been incarcerated for 30 or so years.
So they're going back through the cases now.
Right. They have to review them.
Wow. Wow. Ariel, thank you once again.
Thank you so
bringing
much.
Bringing good stuff to us. Ariel Duham Ross is a science reporter at The Verge here in New York. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about a new comic book, some new superheroes that have nothing to do with Superman and Batman. So it's actually Babbage and Lovelace. Stay with us. You'll find out why. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When does computer history start? If you think it's with the first modern computers, the ENIAC, the Colossus, you wouldn't be wrong, but consider this. A century before those machines got up and running, a rock star inventor and a math prodigy were collaborating on their own computer, and this one was to be steam-powered. I'm talking about Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace. Way back in the Victorian era, they imagined a calculating machine programmed by punch cards. Remember what they are. They called it the analytical engine. But this story, well, it doesn't end very well. Ada Lovelace died at the age of 36, and Babbage's engine never got built until now, sort of. Sydney Padua is a comic artist and animator, and in her new graphic novel, she imagines a new ending for Lovelace and Babbage. Not only do they build their analytical engine, they use it to have adventures. The new book is called The Thrilling Adventures of Lovelace and Babbage. Sydney, welcome to Science Friday.
I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you. Now, you started drawing this comic by accident?
Yes. I was in a pub, I think, with a friend of mine who runs a thing called Ada Lovelace Day, which you might have heard of. It's sort of an online festival to celebrate women in computing. And she said to me, "Oh, you're a woman in tech. You should do a blog post about it." And I said, "I don't even know who Ada Lovelace is." So I pulled up Wikipedia, I think, like anybody would, and read this crazy story, and thought, "This is just a wonderful story. Why have I not heard of this?" So I just kind of tossed off a very short biographical comic.
But you had never done a comic before. Had you?
Well, I'm an animator, so I'd drawn stuff. I mean, I'd drawn a lot of stuff before, but I certainly hadn't sat down to do a comic.
Yeah, you got to tell a story and all that kind of stuff in the comic.
Yeah, I know. Well, so I had to trick myself into it.
So explain the premise of your comic.
As you've laid out, this Babbage had designed with extraordinary detail, actually, this machine made entirely out of cogs and levers it was called Babbage's Great Calculating Machine.
And they were working together? How did they get together to work on this together?
Well, they were friends. They sort of hung out, basically, and talked about stuff. When Lovelace kind of comes into it, when she started out by doing a translation of a paper on Babbage's machine, because, I mean, women at the time did not write scientific papers. It was really unheard of. But so she got her end in the footnotes, sort of by stealth. She started adding all these footnotes in of kind of her ideas of the machine, which for her, while Babbage had designed this machine as a mathematical and an arithmetic machine, basically for doing the very complex math that was needed at the time. For Lovelace, it was this a machine for general information processing, basically. Mm-hmm.
Now, she was famous already. She was the daughter of Lord Byron. As you say, she became quite a good mathematician. And in your comic book, Babbage and Lovelace build the analytical engine, which means you have to draw it a lot. I mean, how do you figure out what it looks like? They never really built it in real life, did they?
No, the plans are actually very detailed, but it was really irritating to me because I was reading all these history of computing books and, you know, even quite technical articles on the engine, and they don't actually give you a drawing of it. They just explain sort of the math of it and, you know, these very abstract theories. So I had to sit down with all these plans and just start doing elevations. I mean, I'm an animator in 3D, you know, so I have computer software for doing exactly this. So I basically just built the machine from Babbage's plans in my own computer, and then sort of drew it off of that.
Yeah, so this sort of became an obsession of yours, didn't it?
Yes. Much to my sorrow, I think.
Well, how obsessed did you become? How did it upset your life?
Well, I mean, at first, I was just drawing the comic at night to blow off steam. I think a lot of the energy from the comic came from the fact that I actually work all day long on these very annoying computers. And the difference engine, of course, in the comic is continually crashing and having all these problems. So it was sort of my revenge on my computer at work to go in and draw this extremely problematic computer. But I guess the more I got into the research of it, you know, because it's a fairly thin field of research. But I think I started the comic around about the same time that Google Books had started dumping all these enormous amounts of Victorian ephemera searchable online. And quite early on in the process, I just thought, well, what would happen if I type Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace into, you know, 19th century Google Books search? And I got enormous amounts of stuff, and all of it was amazing. Like, they were huge personalities, and they were really famous, and there were all these great anecdotes and just really, really fun stuff in there.
What was the relationship like?
Generally speaking, they were very good buddies, I guess I would describe it as. They sort of hung out. I think they both felt that they were misunderstood geniuses that nobody appreciated. So they, I think they complained about how hard that was. They had quarrels here and there, but they were very close friends.
Yeah, I like the wonderful little side trips you take, the little anachronisms, the funny stuff you sort of sneak in the comic. Like, there's one page where Ada says something like, "Now if I can only tweet this," and she says, "Oh wait a minute, this is a fan." You know, it's like Twitter didn't exist back then. You know. Why did you think you needed to do that to keep people's interest, or did it just your own little personality quirk you stuck in there?
Oh, it's definitely my personality quirk. I think anyone who followed the blog would not accuse me of trying to crowd please. it was just completely sort of a stream of consciousness improvisation of sort of bouncing off the research, my own experience with computing and learning about it. I was learning about computing from learning about the analytical engine. So that was kind of an interesting process I started to kind of put up on the blog. Mm-hmm.
And you have a wonderful page where you have all these characters at a party. And it's a good opportunity, I'm sure you use it, to show all the different contemporaries, people who were alive at that time. Darwin and them and all kinds of people alive. And we don't think, you know, that they must have... Did they mix and talk to one another?
Oh, absolutely. They actually hung out at Babbage's parties. Babbage was a very outgoing, sociable guy, and he used to throw these quite famous soirees at his house in London. Darwin went and Faraday went. Charles Dickens would have been there. Actually, the painter Turner was there as well. It was, you know, all the intelligentsia of this period in London would be in this room at the same time.
Yeah. You're going to be, you're going to be giving talks at Microsoft and at Google. Modern? Those are sort of old techies of that period. But how about modern techies? Are they interested in the history of this?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Computing seems such a dry subject to people. You tell people you're drawing a comic book about computers and you see their eyes glaze over. So I think it's nice for I think it's nice for them to see a way that computing can be fun, you know, even if it does have to be a little bit exaggerated.
Well, we wish you great luck. Great luck with it. It's a really fun book. It's a really fun way to learn about them and about the history of computing there. So we wish
you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Sydney Padua is a comic artist and animator. Her new book is The Thrilling Adventures of Lovelace and Babbage. And you can read an excerpt from it at sciencefriday.com/Lovelace. Twenty-five years ago today, the Hubble Space Telescope was rocketed into orbit aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery, and piloting that mission was a Marine Corps officer who would go on to become the administrator of NASA, Charles Bolden. Appointed to head the agency in 2009, Major General Bolden served in the Marine Corps for 34 years, including 14 years as a member of NASA's astronaut office. And on top of that mission to deploy the Hubble, he has been to orbit another three times. And as administrator, he leads NASA through a transitional time, moving from 30 years of space shuttle missions to a time focused on the International Space Station and development of new technologies to take us deeper into space than ever before. We're very fortunate to have General Bolden with us today on Hubble's silver anniversary. Welcome to Science Friday.
Ira, it's awesome to be here. Thanks very much. I look forward to being able to talk to you for years.
Oh, thank you. You could have always come on.
After listening to you and Don Pettit, I wasn't sure I could compete.
Oh, yeah, he's terrific. Don is something else. Tell us about that day 25 years ago. How well do you recall it?
I recall it pretty well, and it was interesting. Yesterday, we were all up at but one of my crew members was up at up at Johns Hopkins University at the Space Telescope Science Institute, and I had an opportunity to participate on a panel with Dr. Steve Hawley, who was the remote manipulator system operator, or the robotic arm operator for the mission. Actually, the person who had to lift Hubble out of the payload bay and ultimately release it into space. And I have been telling people of late that as I mature, I have begun to doubt my own memories of things. I don't want to embellish the things that I did. So I had to check out that day with Steve, and we pretty much agree on the fact that it was a thrilling day. We had thought about that particular mission for a couple of years, actually. We all of us on the crew, and I think the entire Hubble team, knew in some strange way that Hubble would be great. We did not have any idea that it would be as great as it has turned out to be. Nor did we, in our wildest imagination, think that Hubble would be flying after 25 years, performing as an observatory better than its designers had ever envisioned.
Yeah, I think besides what the rovers on Mars and other, some space probes, I think the Hubble is the crown jewel of the NASA system.
I agree with you. And Hubble is better, perhaps, than any other program NASA has ever had. Hubble has managed to capture the imagination of people around the world going on three decades now. And it's not because it was fancy. It's not because it was anything that was overly dramatic. But it's just something that has delivered on a promise to change people's perspective on the universe. It has opened up the possibility of understanding this universe of ours much better by kids from kindergarten all the way up through my age and older. And I think that's the fascination of Hubble. It's kind of like what we're trying to do now on our journey to Mars. We're people have been fascinated by going to Mars for hundreds of years, to be quite honest. If you look back at science fiction writers, they wrote about travel to the other planets, and generally Mars was the dominant planet that everybody wanted to go to. And today we stand on the doorstep of closer than we've ever stood in the history of humanity of actually putting humans in the Martian environment, and we think we can do it in the 2030s with the plan that President Obama and the Congress have allowed us to put together.
In case you joined us, I'm talking with General Charles Bolden, who is the NASA administrator, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I don't think that anybody doubts that we can do it. I think people are wondering if we can afford to do it. I mean, will Congress pay for this?
Ira, you know, I contend that cost is not the challenge.
It's not.
NASA has a relatively healthy budget. $18 billion a year is not chump change. And if you have a plan and you follow the plan the way that we have been doing for the last 5 years, and the plan calls for you to work on a particular spending schedule, then you can accomplish almost anything. We're not asking for a massive infusion of money. What we're asking for is commitment and renewal of national will to continue to lead the world in exploration and to lead the world, take the world with us to do something about which humanity has dreamed for forever, to be quite honest. Mm-hmm. And we think we can do that. If you look at Curiosity, for example, up until now, the United States is actually the only nation that has ever successfully landed any kind of vehicle on Mars and had it operate. And as a result of taking Curiosity, where we had 16 different nations who contributed in some manner, but five nations who have instruments on that one mission alone, there are now that many other nations who can say, look, with the United States, we're on Mars. And that's actually what President Obama has talked about since he came into office, is expanding our international partnerships into non-traditional nations, countries that could not do what we do on their own. We're focused on helping people understand the climate, really focused on helping people, particularly people in underdeveloped or undeveloped nations, solve very simple problems for them. If we understand our climate better, we can try to help get people clean drinking water.
Yeah.
Which is one of the dirty water is the major cause of infant mortality around the world.
You know, and
we can solve that problem.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because every time we talk about space travel, we get listeners who call in and say, you know, why are we going out into space? Why are we spending all that money? We have so many problems here on Earth. And it looks like you folks at NASA have sort of turned that around now a little bit, looking back on Earth to solve some of those problems.
Ira, if you look at our vision statement, and I will paraphrase it, it says we reach for new heights to achieve the unknown so that what we know and what we learn makes this planet better for humanity. And that is our focus all the time. We study Mars. We study other solar systems because we want to understand more about this planet on which we live. We put a great investment into the technology on the International Space Station, one, so that our astronauts can survive and thrive there for long, long periods of time. But an offshoot of that is what some people call spinoffs. It's developing a life support system on the International Space Station where we recycle water. We reuse every type of condensate that we can, whether it's perspiration or pee. And we turn today's coffee into tomorrow's drinking water. So, that's the kind of stuff we do. And we think that's really, really, really important. And we think that is a benefit that we give not to, just to the nation, but to the world.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk more about this. We'll talk about using NASA to talk about global warming and climate change. I'm talking with Charles Bolden, who is NASA's administrator. This is the 25th anniversary of the Hubble Space Telescope. We've just only begun to talk. We'll take a break and come back and talk lots more with the administrator. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with NASA Administrator General Charles Bolden about the future of space exploration. At NASA's 2016 budget hearings, which happened the last month, you had what Washington observers like to say, I think, is a frank exchange of views, as they used to say it, with Senator Ted Cruz, head of the Senate Subcommittee that oversees NASA's budget. I want to play a few clips from that hearing and talk about it a bit. First, he had the following to say about what he thinks NASA's direction should be.
Almost any American would agree that the core function of NASA is to explore space. And you know that I am concerned that NASA, in the current environment, has lost its full focus.
Cruz at no point mentioned global warming, but he is on the record as not believing in human-induced global warming. But it's clear that he is rhetorically pushing back against NASA's role in studying global warming. And in your reply,
we can't go anywhere if the Kennedy Space Center goes underwater and we don't know it.
And you're really not afraid to push back a bit yourself, like the Marine Corps General you are.
Having had an opportunity to view it from a place where I look around, I'm not sure anybody else in here has had that opportunity. We've got to take care of it. And the only way we can take care of it is that we know what's happening. And the only way we know what's happening is to use instruments that we develop in NASA.
So Charles Bolden, I would ask you, what do you have to say to critics who question NASA's roles in Earth sciences? But you said it all on Capitol Hill for yourself.
I didn't say it for myself. I said it for the nation and the people of this world. I am a steward of our planet. I have a 12-year-old granddaughter, Kira, who is an environmental wacko. I mean, she's in love with this planet, and she sends stuff out all the time. She called on all of our relatives to observe Earth Day, and I think I have a responsibility to my three granddaughters and the granddaughters and great-granddaughters and sons of everybody on this planet. And I think the only way we can do that at NASA is to be outspoken and proud of what we do, but to provide valid, detailed data that is collected from the best instruments and the best satellites known to man. We do that, and we do it very proudly. And I challenge anybody to say that they can produce the suite of instruments and satellites that we have done consistently since our inception. That's why other agencies of the federal government come to us to manage some of their satellite programs, particularly in the areas of Earth science, because we have experts and we have people who know how to get the best data for decision makers. And then it's up to the decision makers, the congressmen, the senators, the president, and the cabinet and others to make decisions based on the data we give them. But the data tells us that the planet is changing, and that the planet is changing in many ways that are undesirable and spell a certain end to life as we know it. And that's not being extreme, to be quite honest. So we study other planets in our solar system in order to understand this one better. We study other planets, other places in the universe, because they also help us understand how our own solar system was formed and understand better what can happen or what should happen to this planet on what we live. And we think that's critically important, and that's why we feel that everything we do is a part of the journey to Mars. As I told Senator Cruz, we do want to explore, and we want to be the first in the world in everything that we do, but we want to have a planet that is viable from which we can depart and return.
Mm-hmm. And you don't, you're no shrinking violet. You're not afraid to say what you mean. And scientists have been fearful of speaking out. I know I've spoken to hundreds of them over the years, and they're always afraid of speaking out. But now they think that that we have reached a tipping point in climate change and global warming, that they must say something.
Ira, you know, my wife and I used to live in San Diego, California. We love it out there. But we have friends out on the West Coast now, up and down the West Coast in California and Nevada and other states. They are about to be in crisis. I'm not saying that because I'm a scientist. I'm saying that because I lived out there and I saw the reservoirs going down and down and down. All of our instruments say that we have used groundwater to such an extent when we are getting less water from normal means like rain and snowfall that we better do something quick. Yeah. And so that's not trying to induce panic in anyone. It's just saying, listen, look at the data. And as Senator Cruz said, let science direct us in the proper direction.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about science and the future of science. You talked about the desire to go to Mars. Let's talk about the space station, the International Space Station. It's got a finite life, President Putin of Russia said recently that they want to go it alone and build their own space station, the next one. I'm sure you heard that comment.
I heard that, but I think what I would ask everybody to go back and listen to and pay attention to is the comments that came out of Mr. Komarov, who is my counterpart with the Russian space agency, Roscosmos, on the morning after he and I stood together and watched Scott Kelly and his crew members launch to the International Space Station for what will be a historic one-year mission. And after talking with Mr. Komarov and his team for a couple of days, we all came away with several things on which we agreed. One was that we should extend, as President Obama has recommended, we should extend the life of the International Space Station to at least 2024. Another statement he made was that we should expand the numbers of nations that we bring into the fold of spacefaring nations so that we're able to take advantage of the best of all worlds and take it, let allow more people to have the opportunity to do the things that our two nations do. Mm-hmm. And third, that, you know, actually we should work together with all of our partner nations in shoring up the pathway to Mars. Everybody agrees that Mars is the ultimate destination for humanity. Most people agree on the path that we've selected. Most people agree on our choice of shoring up the low Earth orbit infrastructure by turning to American industry and utilizing commercial crew and cargo capabilities to get us to space so that we can spend money going deeper into space. So yeah, I think we are much in agreement.
There's no loss of, you know, Elon Musk talks about, I'll take you to Mars if you want to. I can build that spaceship too. There's certainly no loss of interest there. But one of the things you did mention out of NASA in going to Mars is that the first trip to Mars you think should be an orbital trip. Not landing there, but just, I guess, testing out the feasibility of getting there and coming back.
If you look at the current technologies that we have and our understanding of the human body, most of our team right now says, for now, let's think about, going, flying an orbital mission. Now, an orbital mission may mean we stay there for weeks. We're not saying how long that mission should be, but we want it to be a scout mission, if you will. I don't want to introduce any new terms here, but it would be very similar to the way that we approach the moon. You demonstrate the capability to get there and to operate safely there. You demonstrate that the technologies that we've developed, like life support systems and the like, can withstand the environment, the different environment of being that far away from Earth. And maybe you begin to work with some robotic precursors that are either on one of the moons of Mars or preferably on the surface of Mars, and maybe let the crew begin to direct some of those robotic precursors to begin to burrow into the Martian soil and do the first stages of construction of the habitats in which humans are going to live. Today, there is no reason for us to put an astronaut on the surface of Mars to build a house.
Yeah.
We should be using robots for that. We do that here on Earth. You look at an automobile production line, aircraft production line, houses. Most of them are prefab. I mean, even the very expensive ones where the robots put them together and then humans go out and do the finishing touches. And that's the way we should approach Mars.
Now we can 3D print them.
We're almost there. We're not quite there. You know, I would say, Ira, in all honesty, we are really moving along rapidly in taking what industry and entrepreneurs have given us. We did not develop 3D printing, I am very proud to say. And I'm proud to say that is because what you find NASA doing today, much more than before, is trying to get out of the what people used to accuse us of was the not invented here syndrome.
Right.
We are trying to take the best of all technologies, synergize them with those that we are really good at developing so that we get the final product, which is something that's going to put humans successfully on Mars, going to have a viable low Earth orbit infrastructure that's run dominantly by American industry, return launches of American astronauts to American soil the way that it should be, develop a space launch system, a heavy lift launch vehicle with the Orion crew module that's going to send humans farther into our solar system than ever before, and do a number of other things while taking care of our planet by being good stewards of our environment through our Earth science missions.
Well, we wish you the best of luck. We won't wait so long to have you back. administrator.
Oh, thank you. Just don't bring me on with Don Pettit.
He's a tough act to follow.
He's a tough act to follow, and I don't invent zero-gravity coffee cups.
You heard that. That's great.
I listened intently. It was a great show.
Well, congratulations. We wish everybody at NASA a happy anniversary for us with the Hubble, and have a great weekend, and thanks for coming on to celebrate with us.
Ira, thank you so very much. It's been my pleasure and an honor for me. I've looked forward to this for quite some time.
You're quite welcome. Thank you very much. Charles Bolden, NASA Administrator. Next up, our video producer Luke Graskin joins us to talk about the latest video in our Macroscope series, which you can see up on sciencefriday.com, or you could subscribe to the series on YouTube. Welcome, Luke. What's under the macroscope, our macroscope this week?
Hi, Ira. Well, this week we're looking at a bit of a hot topic. We're looking at perceptions of evolution, more specifically the story of a woman, Dr. Amanda Glaze, who teaches and researches evolution in the American Southeast. And she was born and raised a devout Southern Baptist with a literalist point of view of the Bible. And today she's a tireless advocate of evolution in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's been 90 years since the Scopes so-called monkey trial, and the debate about evolution in the Southeast continues on. This stuff just sort of comes up and it swells up and down periodically, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it's still always under the surface.
It's always under the surface. It's still a pretty taboo subject down there. People don't bring it up in their everyday life. Where it does come up and where it becomes controversial is when you talk about it in the classroom. And that's where people broach the subject very, very carefully, as they should.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Luke Graskin, our video about what's under the macroscope this week. Now, you spoke with about a half a dozen teachers in rural Alabama for this video. Did they seem comfortable teaching the subject?
In varying degrees. So Dr. Amanda Glaze seemed very confident, very bold about it. But some of the other teachers I spoke to expressed fear about what the students would say when they got home to their parents. You know, some felt very confident and certain they were still going to teach it. But everyone expressed, including Dr. Glaze, mm-hmm. a great degree of sensitivity to what their students' backgrounds were. And, you know, some expressed that they didn't have the willingness to kind of talk about this fully based on their own background. Here's what Dr. Amanda Glaze said about that.
A lot of times we see things like a teacher coming into a classroom and telling students, I'm not comfortable with this. This does not agree with what I believe in, but I'm required to teach it by the standards. So we're going to talk about this for today. But it sends conflicting messages, much like having disclaimers in textbooks. You're sending a very conflicting message when the textbook says, here is this chapter on evolution, here's what's going on, but yet you have a disclaimer in the front of the book that says, evolution is just a theory.
Hmm. So she's referring to there a 2006 disclaimer that's put in all Alabama science textbooks that basically puts a little asterisk on the theory of evolution. And there are other states that have this, and there are other states that actually permit creationism to be openly taught. Actually, now I'm thinking about it, it's not openly taught, but there's a recent, in Louisiana, there was a recent story that showed that some teachers are actually teaching it anyway.
Yeah. Now, she has a background, a typical Southern background herself, right?
She does.
And she's had her own soul-searching about how to teach this.
She does. She was born and raised devout Southern Baptist, and it's pretty unique to go from that to becoming a tireless advocate. She also researches the subject extensively, kind of ethnographically or sociologically, and she's actually done surveys with pre-service teachers and tried to figure out what exactly is their point of view on evolution. Mm-hmm. And in those studies, she's kind of found that they aren't tireless advocates like her. They have a very moderate acceptance of evolution.
And so Dr. Glaze doesn't believe that there should be a debate about evolution, or she says there should be a place we should all agree where it should be taught.
Well, she definitely believes evolution needs to be taught. She's very, very certain about that. But in terms of a debate, she believes that there's a bit of a false dichotomy that's been created across America, where we believe that if you are tirelessly, you know, if you are a strong advocate of being faithful, that you can't actually believe in evolution. And then the opposite, whereas if you are strong advocate of evolution and you really, really believe in evolution, you can't have a spiritual life. She believes that's a false dichotomy, and it doesn't create room for acceptance and for students, future students, to believe it.
Let's talk about your experience in Alabama. What did you come away with this? How do you look differently about the whole issue since you've talked to all these teachers?
I truly didn't understand how I think it's like 42% of the country could be creationist. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised in New England, and so I didn't really get it. And then I went there and I definitely got it. And I was very intrigued with her point of view, Dr. Glaze's point of view. I don't personally agree with it, but that's okay. I think it's a point of debate, and I think people should go watch the video, go to sciencefry.com, and weigh in for themselves and decide, you know, is this a false dichotomy? It'd be interesting to hear what people think.
Yeah, and we can see the video.
Sciencefriday.com. It's called The Pot Stirrer.
All right. It's our video. It's our under the macroscope. And if you want to see or hear about a video, go to sciencefriday.com, where you can also leave your views. If you've watched the video and you have some views about it, we want you to leave your views with us on our website. And you can continue the discussion if you'd like. On Tuesday, April 28th, we're having a live Google Hangout. Folks will be discussing the best way to sensitively talk about evolution in communities that don't feel comfortable about talking about it. That's Tuesday, April 28th. Head over to sciencefriday.com evolution to find out more and join our Google Hangout. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to Bob Isaacson and our production partners at the studios at the City University of New York. You can keep the Hubble celebration going by reading about one of Hubble's most iconic images, The Pillars of Creation, written by our own Julie Leibach at sciencefriday.com/pillars. And if you like us on Facebook, we're tweeting all week long. Head over to our website. We've got all kinds of good stuff for you there this week. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.